WPFW, Washington.
You're worried about the economy. You're worried about health care and the debt in Arizona apartheid and Sarah Palin. But have you been paying attention to the robots? Yes, the robots. Stay tuned if you dare. Well, good morning and welcome to What's at Stake. This is the Terry DeKester edition of What's at Stake. And as always, it is a privilege to be with you. We are going to have a fascinating show this morning, a show that takes us in a different direction, that takes us to pay attention, I hope, to an area that we're not really exploring and we need to explore because the implications are, of course, profound. I'm talking about robots. Now, as you know, now this may seem a strange topic for What's at Stake, but I guarantee you, if you pay attention and stay with us, you are going to learn things about what is happening in the world of robots and robotics that will fascinate you, that will intrigue you, that will challenge you, might even scare you. At any rate, let me point out a few things here before I introduce my guest. The CIA, as you know, is now part of our military, blowing supposed bad guys to smithereens with smaller and smaller, more and more stealthy drones, missiles, and bombs. The CIA. Next year, your child will crave and cry for Zeno, a robotic companion, a friend you can trust. And, of course, you know that robots already build your cars, explore planets for us, make our candy, perform the most invasive surgeries with far more skill, finesse, and accuracy than any mere doctor. And for all we know, robots are the brewmeisters and tasters of our best brewed beers. The robots are here. A good scholar of mankind's history will tell you that we usually recognize the problems, the challenges that face our societies as they develop. But we do not usually pay them any significant attention. We fight the last war and improve that which already exists. Immigration, the world of finance, health care, all of these urgent problems should have been solved 12, 20, 30 years ago. Proof of our profound procrastination? Well, the deficiencies within Social Security and Medicare, within a known, easily predictable trend and demographic, and yet we still do nothing. Katrina, with years of studies and warnings that the levees would not hold, and we did nothing. Most tragic of all, global warming, which we've known about for decades, and yet we still do nothing. Well, the same dangerous human delay and denial is playing out in regard to the astonishing birth and spread of robots. We know already, or we'll learn today, what part robots already play and will play in our lives, in our ever-quickening future. Yet we as individuals, politicians, teachers, are for the most part as blind as a robotic vacuum cleaner. We're simply not paying attention to the consequences of their inevitable integration into our lives. But their creators are, and so are the robots. As we begin paying attention today, keep in mind not only their integration into every corner of our society, but some of the defining issues of robotics, which include robotic autonomy and their ability to distinguish and their ethics. We will first examine robots in modern warfare, and in the second segment, we will turn to robots as companions and friends. I am privileged this morning to have two distinguished guests joining us on the air to discuss robotics. First is Professor William Red L. Whitaker from Carnegie Mellon University. Good morning, Professor Whitaker.
Morning. Great to be with you.
Thank you so much for joining us. And second is Peter Asaro. Peter, thank you so very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Terry. It's good to be here.
Okay. Let me introduce a little bit better these gentlemen. Dr. Whitaker, interestingly, in the March of the year that he received his Ph.D., the same year, the nuclear reactor at nearby Three Mile Island nearly experienced a meltdown. within a budget of just $1.5 million, Whitaker and his colleagues at Carnegie Mellon built robots to inspect and perform repairs in the reactor's damaged basement. And their experiences with that project resulted in the creation of the Field Robotics Center at Carnegie Mellon University. At Carnegie Mellon, Professor Whitaker is the Friedkin Professor of Robotics and founder also of the National Robotics Engineering Consortium, all again at Carnegie Mellon University. He is also the chief scientist of Red Zone Robotics. He's wide known for his achievements in the robotics community. A few of his awards include the Engelbert Technology Award, the Design News Special Achievement Award, the Hero of Manufacturing Award, and the Aviation and Space Technology Award. Dr. Whitaker has 16 patents and has authored or co-authored over 200 publications. He is also, interestingly, leading the Carnegie Mellon University team, which is competing in the Google Lunar X Prize, the challenge to get to the moon with a robot. And as the chairman of CTO of Astrobotic Technology, Whitaker will play an instrumental role in further lunar development. Peter Asaro approaches, I think, robotics from a different point of view. He is a philosopher of science and technology and media. He's a member of the faculty of the Department of Media Studies and Film at the New School University, New York, and affiliated with the Center for Cultural Analysis at Rutgers University, New Jersey. He has written several articles on new technologies and their ethical challenges, as well as on military robots and just war theory. His work extends to engineering ethics and particularly design, social and emotional robotics, and the new media communication technologies. He is currently focusing on the use of robotics for police and military applications. Peter Asaro and Dr. Whitaker, welcome again to What's at Stake. Dr. Whitaker, let me begin with you, if I may. There's a fascinating article in the Washington Post just this week, just Monday, I believe it was, about the use of robotics and with the CIA in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Of course, we know about the Predator, and apparently the Reaper is more advanced than the Predator. Let's begin with that military understanding of robotics. We hear a lot of it in the news. I don't know if we pay enough attention to what's really happening, but where do we stand at this point in terms of robotic technology and those particular weapons of war?
These and others that are called defense robots now are controlled by humans. They are remote machines that fly, swim, crawl. They're for the most part observers, and then the threshold that is crossed more recently is active fire. They come in all sizes, and these really are machines that have automated features, and that's what distinguishes them, and that's why some of the world calls them robots.
Would you expand a bit on what you mean by automated features?
Well, most listeners who drive brake with a pedal in their car, but don't think about automated braking. Or they might have a washing machine, and it's an automatic washing machine. Or so what underlies the brake pedal is mechanics, electronics, and software that sense and coordinate brakes in ways that humans couldn't possibly do. Or you might recall a few years ago with Ford Explorers tipping over and manufacturers pointing at tire companies pointing at drivers and drivers pointing back. And in the end, that would lead to automated tip-over control to do quickly and responsibly what humans might not. So people don't think about robotics or don't think about the automated feature each time they wash some clothes or drive to the grocery store. And then the how it gets done are with automated features. And there are some that, for whatever reasons, people call robots.
And it is interesting, Professor Whitaker, that you already have mentioned, you know, that they do it better than humans can do it, which is partly where we're leading and heading today in our discussion. There are things that they certainly do better than we can do. And regarding the how, I remember the very first computer course I took many years ago, and I was told by the instructor, don't ask the question how or why.
You know, well, about the why, it's not there are many, many cases where the machines are inferior, but they're utilized. You introduced the cleanup, for example, of a nuclear accident.
Mm-hmm.
And machines are utilized.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily because they are more competent than humans. In the extreme radiation exposures, humans are not the agents of choice. Or, for example, you mentioned a technical prize that I am pursuing.
Mm-hmm. The Google?
Google Prize. Mm-hmm. A little bit like Lindbergh landing in Paris for his $25,000. I have the experience of winning a driverless car race for $2 million, and this offers $25 million for a robot conveying experience from the moon.
I've got to get to Peter Acero here, but how soon does launch happen? I mean, when is that planned?
End of 2012, beginning of 2013. Another way to say it is maybe 30-some months.
30-some months, and this is all basically a private endeavor, I mean, with Carnegie Mellon, et cetera, but it's a private endeavor. It's not, NASA's not building your rocket or your equipment.
Well, the only reason I brought those distinctions up of that it will be a robot is that's what they pay the prize for, or
mm-hmm.
that the reason it would be non-federal is that those are the rules.
Mm-hmm.
And whether it's enterprise or robotics or the discussion that we have today, there are always the guidelines. And one of the first principles is to play by the rules.
Okay. All right. Peter Acero, I'm sure you want to weigh in on this, and I don't want to, you know, obsess the show with some of the things that robots do, because there's many things that they do, both positive and negative. But we are using robotic elements anyway, robotic machinery, to kill today, which is certainly relatively new in the annals of warfare. Your comments and thoughts at this point?
Yeah, so there's currently over 10,000 robots in Iraq, Afghanistan.
Keep your phone close to your mouth, if you would, please. I have a little trouble hearing you. Thank you.
There's over 10,000 robots in Iraq and Afghanistan right now that are being used by the military. However, only about 10 to 20, maybe 30 of these are actually armed with lethal weapons at this point. And that's a new technology in that sense. But it's a direction in which the military is investing heavily in developing a lot of new technology. And right now, all of these lethal robotic systems are being controlled remotely, as I said, such that there's, you know, generally in the controllers are actually in Nevada and places like that, so halfway around the world. But they have the ability to deliberate at length about whether or not to fire a missile at a specific target, and they can watch the target for hours on end. And so that process of what I would call lethal decision-making, or the decision of whether or not to use a lethal force, is still being made by humans and in a very deliberate and thoughtful way. But there's also discussions and technological possibility of automating that process. And I think that's really a line that we don't want to cross as a country or really as a human civilization. And part of my work is actually trying to organize an international treaty to ban automated lethal decision-making of that kind in the way that we've banned anti-personnel landmines.
That sort of leads to the heart of part of the discussion I want to get into. I read here in Discover magazine that the National Defense Authorization Act of 2000 mandates that by 2010, one-third of the military's combat aircraft be unmanned, and that by 2015, one-third of all combat vehicles be unmanned. Obviously, we're behind schedule on that, but that's a wild goal. And it brings up in the articles that as the robots become more and more complex, including new developments of the Predator or the Reaper, that right now can take only a very narrow visual view of what it is attacking or searching for. But in a short time, they have developed robotic Predators or Reapers that will be able to get like 96 separate visual images of the surrounding area. And, of course, it's almost impossible for a human being to monitor 96 particular images. I've directed TV. Once you get above 5 visual images, it's getting pretty complex. And so the robot, of course, has to begin to decide what visual images does the human operator need to pay attention to. So the robot is beginning to be programmed to distinguish the word I mentioned in the beginning, between what is of value to the viewer and what is not of the value to the viewer. In other words, we're building autonomy and distinguishing into the robots. We almost need to because of the growing complexity. Professor Whitaker, your comments, please.
The majority of unmanned systems are co-manned, and there are two bases for that. The first is something like a truck that would have shared use. And the vast majority of that time, it would be driven by soldiers, and there might be occasions when there would be a utility for teleoperating it.
Let me encourage you again, I'm sorry to interrupt, to keep the phone close to your mouth. We're having a little trouble picking you guys up. Much better, thank you.
Shared use means that something, a robot that can be teleoperated or remote controlled can also accommodate a driver. And a cargo truck that would be used most of the time by human driver might be used some of the time by teleoperation. The other motivation for unmanned is the physical form of the device and small airplane might be stay aloft for a long time, or be undetectable, or be launched from a pickup truck, or an IED robot the size of a shoebox or the size of an office chair doesn't have volition. It is operated either through a TV link or line of sight by an operator. So much of the unmanned label is a myth. Then regarding perception and decision-making and volition, the instances that we're discussing that exist today are deliberate decision making, and that's distinct from the next step, which would be reactive fire. And deliberate means that humans that are in control and overseeing are the ones that make the decisions and operate, and the difference is that the human wouldn't have hands on the hardware, but that the hardware would be remote from the human.
Yeah, and we already have that developed to some degree. One of the articles, again, points out that on the DMZ between North Korea and South Korea, we have robotic machine guns basically set up, and that, you know, basically they shoot without command. They shoot almost anything that appears. And if a child, according to the article, you know, happens to wander into the DMZ, which we don't think a child would wander into the DMZ, but if it happened and it walks in within sight of this particularly robotic device, the machine gun will shoot. That's what it's set to do. Peter Asaro, again, on distinguishability and the distinguishing the ability of the robots or the need for robots to begin to distinguish because of the complexity of the situation or simply because we don't want to be involved in the risk. Your comments, please.
So several things of what you just said. So first, the demilitarized zone is actually a very special place in international law because it's technically still an open war.
The demilitarized zone is the most heavily militarized zone we've got.
Right, right. And so actually even the anti-personnel landmine treaties and certain other treaties don't apply there. And so it is legal to have a an autonomous machine gun that will shoot anybody. It doesn't have to distinguish because there's not supposed to be anybody there. It doesn't have to distinguish which side you're on or whether you're a civilian or not. It's legal to shoot anybody in the demilitarized zone.
So we've surrendered distinguishability there.
Right. But under normal just war theory and say, the Geneva Conventions, in order to allow these kinds of systems to operate, they need to have some level of discrimination between civilians and combatants. And there are certain systems, like the Patriot missile system, that have an automatic mode that are supposed to detect incoming missiles. Now, they sometimes incorrectly identify high-speed aircraft as missiles and will automatically target them, and this resulted in some friendly fire incidents in the Iraq War in 2003. They shot down an F-18 American plane and
our own Patriot missile shot down one of our own aircraft.
Right, and that was through an automated system. So there are ways to develop an automated system which tries to make these kinds of distinctions. How successful that is, of course, is an empirical question and depends on the engineering and a lot of other things.
There's also the point, Peter, of the fact that over 50 nations right now are in enthusiastic business of developing robotic military uses. And, obviously if there are that many nations developing 50 different robotic solutions to warfare, these machines are going to get into, again, sort of a conflict, a face-on-face situation, a machine against a machine. And, again, this thing of autonomy and distinguishability seems to become more urgent, particularly in time frame. So how does that weigh into the whole picture at this point with 50 nations now developing weapons of war that are essentially robotic?
Yeah, well, they're a new technology, and we don't know exactly how they're going to act, what they're going to do, what the implications of that are. And then they're also challenging existing international standards and laws. And I think those are both problems, potential problems, sources of new kinds of problems. And we don't have any kind of international framework for really regulating what kinds of systems are going to be allowed or disallowed or how people are going to design these. And I think the big danger is are really systems that, if you're talking about these unmanned aerial vehicles that are going to be patrolling borders, and you're going to arm them, and then, say there are India and Pakistan both have UAVs patrolling each side of their border, and one gets blown off course and meets the other, what happens? So now if we end up starting an armed conflict or escalating an existing sort of conflict to a new level of violence through an automated system, I think there's, you know, there's something to really worry about in those kinds of situations.
And we have no international agreements, nothing within the UN yet, nothing between this country and that country on any kind of limits or connectivity between robotic efforts, do we?
No. And I mean, there's all sorts of existing laws of warfare which cover these situations, but they do so in a very coarse way that doesn't necessarily recognize the nature of automation or the capabilities of these robotic systems.
Dr. Whitaker, I sensed you wanted to jump in here.
I'm recalling the eve of the first Gulf War and how much concern and consideration there was for how many would be killed, how those first violent days would fare. And my experience is that on the eve of battle, there is a tremendous concern and consideration for human life and why the humans are at risk. And regarding the these machines creating incidents, most of the listeners would not be old enough to recall the U-2 incident. We even called it an incident. And I bring it up because it was a reconnaissance overflight. And the problem was that it was a manned flight.
Which was shot down.
I'm impressed that you would remember that.
I am old enough. Yes, it was at 60,000 feet. It was flying over Russia.
Yes. But, and then what that led to was their capture display, a very forceful, I guess it was called a confession at the time.
From the pilot, right.
Gary Powers,
right.
10 years of hard labor. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's so interesting that when we finally did get them back, and by the way, these are international incidents.
Yeah.
And when we did get them back, we castigated them. And it was an ugly, cold reception because he didn't kill himself and he didn't destroy his plane.
Yeah, that's absurd.
Well, no. What you want to understand is that part of this relates to what is it that's at risk when it's a machine in action versus a human. The other that I thought of when Peter was speaking was...
Let me ask you to hold that only because we're at that magic time in radio where we have to take a break, and we'll get right back to that. This is Terry D. Kester. The show is What's at Stake. We're discussing robotics in warfare. We're going to be discussing robotics when we come back. We'll finish up a little bit here, and then we'll go on to robotics in terms of personal robotics, personal friends who are robots, as the goal is of some companies. And this is WPFW 89.3 FM Pacifica. It is a little past 10:30. We're taking a short break here, and we'll be right back to figure out what the robots are going to do next.
Why is it always the fight? I can't get on.
And once again, good morning. This is Terry D. Kester on What's at Stake at WPFW 89.3 FM Pacifica. I do want to mention to you, I will be with you again next week. We will discuss other topics, and there certainly are plenty of topics to discuss, as you know. And again, I always consider it a privilege to be with you. I also want to mention that I hope you'll come down and join us at Ben's Next Door at on Tuesday nights at 7 p.m., where we do the Raucous Caucus. We rotate Mark and Garland and myself on who's leading the show. I'll be leading the show next Tuesday, 7 o'clock, Raucous Caucus at Ben's. Not only is the food great down there, but we always have a good audience, and we have questions, of course, from the audience. It's an open discussion that we open to you. And we will be able to, we've had some technical problems in the past, but we will be able to not only have audience members submitting questions and talking to us, but we also will be able to open our phone lines and have callers as we've had in the past. So that's we'd rather have you come down to the restaurant itself and be there in person. It's really quite an enjoyable show. We have a lot of fun with it. The Raucous Caucus is Tuesday night, 7 p.m. at Ben's Next Door, 12th and U. But right now, we're talking about robots. We're talking to Professor Whitaker, William Red Whitaker from Carnegie Mellon University. And we're talking to Peter Asserol, who is a philosopher and academic regarding robotics and the emotions in robotics and intelligence in robotics and their impact within society, and particularly in terms of war. We've been talking about war and use of robotics, where people are probably most familiar with the robotic things. I want to move on here in just a moment, but I want to bring in one other idea. And that is the there's a new robot that's being developed, and it's by a company named Vecna, and it's called the, I love the acronyms that are developed. The robot is called Bear, and it's a battlefield extradition assist robot. At this point, it is supposedly meant to be able to retrieve wounded soldiers, of course, which is a noble cause. But this robot is going to be able to be self-sustaining, and self-sustaining by consuming, I gather, if I read this correctly, organic whatever, you know, that happens to be about to provide energy for itself, and it will be a self-sustaining robot in the field. So let me interject that into the conversation, gentlemen, and give me an idea more of where we're headed in the future of robotics on the war field. We've spoken a lot about control and trying to have control. We've mentioned a little bit about autonomy and distinguishment or distinguishability. It seems obvious to me that the more complex the situation gets on the battlefield, the shorter the reaction times are, the more that the robots need to be autonomous, the more that they can do, the more that they need just technologically to be autonomous, and therefore they have to distinguish, and therefore we're passing off control to them. So give me a sense of where the future is, even if you disagree with my premise or not, but where is the future in battlefield robotics, particularly as, again, we are moving towards one-third of the aircraft and one-third of the ground vehicles being robotic within a few years. Let me start with you, Dr. Whitaker.
I'm reflecting on Jessica Lynch, who was captured during a convoy run that encountered a dust storm and lost its way, turned right into the enemy.
All right.
And how completely preventable that is with automation features appended to cargo delivery and the substantial risks and consequences on the road to Baghdad. And so cargo and logistics support is an unquestioned direction. You've already mentioned rescue,
mm-hmm.
and the risks of rescue and exposure are substantial, and I've mentioned that risk is very a very big motivation in robotic application. The next would be reactive fire. Your listeners might...
Again, let me encourage you to speak close to the phone. We're having, for some reason or another, we're having a little bit of connection problem, so speak as close to the
listeners,
phone.
Listeners might recall Black Hawk Down and Somalia in 93, and that what we sent were human-driven convoys and human snipers and human rescue, which led to what it led to. And as you point out, the time frames are short, and what counts is reaction, and that that will be odd direction for future automation.
Well, there's no question in that direction. I mean, that robots and robotic development will provide a service. But there is the issue, obviously, of how far removed we become as human beings from the battlefield. Now, at this point, it's new enough, excuse me, please, that I know that the unmanned vehicles, excuse me one moment, please. I'm very sorry. That the operators of those seem to be quite sensitive to the human situation, and there's all kinds of safeguards built in. But the fact of the matter is, we're becoming further and further removed from the actual conflict, which has been the history of warfare. I mean, we started out, you know, hand to hand, and we kept on moving further and further back as we get greater and greater weapons and greater technology. Now we're sitting in Nevada while we're bombing Afghanistan or protecting troops in Afghanistan. And what I, and both elements are there, but, you know, obviously, it seems obvious to me, Peter Asaro, that the more developed it gets, the more that we're having machinery fight our war. The enemy is, of course, going to respond, whatever the enemy may be. The enemies may, in fact, get their own drones. They can sacrifice a drone even easier, of course, than they can sacrifice, well, maybe not easier than some human beings, but... Where even while it may work at the moment because we seem to have the advantage, aren't we heading towards robotic warfare on one level or another in certain areas of the world?
Yeah, so there's different things that happen. I mean, I think most of the development is going towards this dull, dirty, dangerous kind of uses of robotics. But as that moves into the military realm, a lot of that is associated with lethality. And, you know, there's an obvious advantage for the military to reduce the risk to soldiers by taking them out of the aircraft, remote controlling these things from very far away.
But this keep close to the phone,
other
please.
Secondary kinds of implications, which are that now that we have, you know, pilots and staff in Nevada who are fighting in Afghanistan, well, that also then means that the war zone in Afghanistan extends to Nevada. So now Nevada, under international law, might be considered a legal war zone. So if Al-Qaeda attacked there, it would be legal under the Geneva Conventions, which would have, you know, strange implications for trying terrorists in the United States, perhaps. The other thing is that as the CIA takes over these, are the CIA part of the military? Are they civilians? Are now we having civilians who are fighting or doing military-like things? Are we starting to erode this distinction between soldiers and civilians that, again, would seem to justify certain forms of terrorism or confuse international law even further than it already has been. So I think, I mean, that just, you know, the capability of these machines to make those kinds of legal issues questionable is itself something that we need to be concerned about, as well as the fact that these are getting more lethal, and there's other countries that are developing them, and they will use them in ways that we haven't thought of yet.
All right. Again, I asked both of you to stick close to that phone. I don't know why, but we're just having a little bit of signal problem, so we've got to make sure that on both ends that we are as close to the mic or telephone that we can possibly be. We're speaking to Professor Whitaker from Carnegie Mellon University. We're speaking to Peter Azarol, philosopher and ethicist regarding ethics. I'm sorry, regarding robotics. I want to move now into the more personal field, which I know is a bit of a little bit beyond both of your particular expertise, but certainly not beyond your knowledge. And first off, I've got to really thank you for sticking with us for the whole hour. We had another guest here, and I wish we could have had him, but he turned out to not be available. He's head of Hanson Robotics in Dallas, Texas. And he, on the other hand, develops robots from a different point of view. And I'm going to have to read some of his information to get us into the conversation about more personal robotics. Hanson Robotics develops and manufactures human-like robots and smart software that brings our robots to life. The Hanson robots include the world's first expressive bipod robot, which was called Albert Hubo, and essentially was a recreation face. They use a new form of foam rubber that looks just like skin. It was a recreation of Albert Einstein, and it was heralded by Wired magazine as genius. I mentioned in the very beginning there is a new robot they're putting out called Xeno, and Xeno is a low-cost child robot who, in Hanson Robotics terms, is evolving into a family member. This is a small robot. It will be on the market supposedly next year. The more complex version will cost about $2,500. The simpler version will cost a mere $300. This is a small robot that will be able to, that looks like a small little boy, somewhat cartoonish on purpose. It will be able to just talk to you. It will be able to recognize faces. It will be able to, you know, remember things that you have said in the past and to interact with you. Part of their goal, they actually say, is to understand and model the human being, deliver, by understanding and modeling from the human being, they hope to deliver living robotic characters to the consumer and accelerate progress towards greater than human intelligence in machines. They ask that you join them in this quest to build a better, smarter future. They even have gone so far as to develop the eyes. These robots have complete facial expressions. You may have seen an example of one of them at the Kennedy Center last year. Japan had a display. I forget which company created it. Japanese humanoids or human-like robots. Hanson Robotics is developing and working on the eyes, in their words, so that you almost are peering into their souls. They are really pushing in terms of artificial intelligence, in terms of the physicality of the robots. They are very human-like. There's even the example within their work of a man who decided to have a robot created to be and look like and act like his wife. Now, and there's a photograph of her. It's very realistic. It looks just like her. How far this went in terms of recreating his wife as a robot and what part she was playing in this, I have no idea. I would love to be able to talk to them. But this use of robots in the home as companions is definitely a goal of a lot of companies, not to mention using robots in various service positions. And it brings a whole new dimension to it. In one of the articles in Discover magazine, and I'm not sure who it was, it was that panel discussion that you were part of, Dr. Whitaker. One of the people asked about, or one of the questions was, well, will there be robots, you know, that will be used for sex? Which is rather, to me, a rather repulsive consideration. But nevertheless, the answer was, well, once we got the Internet up, it soon became obvious that the primary use of the Internet seems to be for pornography. Therefore, as robots become more and more human-like, there's no reason to assume that robots would not be able or would not become sexual partners as well. And this obviously is a whole different direction than we normally talk about. Let me start with you again, Dr. Whitaker. I know this is a little bit different field. Where is this leading in your mind? Where can this lead?
The great market is elder care. one of the reasons why Japan, with its aging population, parts of the United States press in this area, the interaction and the memory could be very valuable for example, early stage Alzheimer and reinforcing what's important to remember and know. Pharmacare, administering medications, providing medications, reminders. There's no question about the enchantment of animatronics and anthropomorphics. For whatever reason, people seem intrigued by machines that are in their own image. And you may, the 30-year-old, 40-year-old version of it might have been Disney animatronics, so as a principle, there's nothing new. And that there are the animal versions, the dogs that have once the Aibo dogs that were RoboSoccer and it is a sustaining bridge between toys and technology. And then it's true that all these robots are tools, and at least some of them are toys. And that's as good a market and as good a technology as any of the others we'll speak about.
And Peter Acero, jump in here. You're going to have a robotic friend in your house soon, and what are you going to expect of that robotic friend, and what is the implication in your mind in terms of social relationships, if any? Is there a point, just like the Internet occupies so much of our energy today and our time, that if we have a robotic companion, you know, there are certainly going to be good uses, as Dr. Whitaker pointed out, but if I have a robotic companion at home, do I need Mom?
you always need Mom.
Okay, good.
Yeah, so I actually did a feature documentary about 10 years ago, A Love Machine, about...
Right, I should have mentioned that.
So it's interesting to see first how much progress has been made and how that progress has proceeded over the last 10 years. It's not nearly as fast as the military technology is the first thing to note. And it's mostly because of the investment. Military technology's got a lot of investment, where the toy robots, the social and emotional robots, are still... mostly small companies, even the bigger companies like Sony dumped their Aibo robotic dog project at one point. But where the technology is advanced, and I mean, if you look at Hanson's robot videos on their website, they're really, really amazing quality.
Yes.
In terms of the facial expressions, what they're able to do with this rubber technology that really does look like skin in a way that... Even, you know, 10 years ago, there was nothing that came close to that level of human-like emotive facial expression. but in terms of actual human relationships, I don't know that, you know, the face and the detail of facial expression is really the thing that allows people to forge friendships and human social relations. And you can even, you know, do this... over the telephone, right? You don't need a face at all in some sense. But there's this sense that the culture wants to continue to mediate these kinds of social relations. And I think it's an expression of human society and culture. I don't know if it's right or wrong or good or bad or how we can necessarily judge that. People will continue to build these things and explore the different kinds of relationships they can have with them, the different lifestyles they make possible. But I think much like the Internet, right, that it's also going to create human distance because it allows us to not interact with each other in a lot of different ways. And what are the real applications of a lot of these things? I mean, I think you're going to see, you know, robotic heads at fast food restaurants or, you know, places where you might have seen a vending machine before or something like that. Maybe it can be a little more human. But we're really just kind of automating these what used to be real human relationships. And then I think there's also the kind of labor implications of what does it mean if we're replacing fast food workers with robots? Is that good because we don't like fast food jobs? Or, you know, right now there's not a lot of jobs. So I think everybody wants some kind of job. And if we're creating self-driving cars and buses and trucks and airplanes, then, you know, what happens to the bus drivers and the pilots and the Teamsters? So I think there's a lot of secondary social issues that will emerge from these new forms of automation.
All right. Well, unfortunately, gentlemen, we're going to have to leave it there. We have run out of time, and only because the discussion requires so much. I really do thank both you, Professor Whitaker and Peter Esserol, for joining us on What's at Stake to begin this discussion. Obviously, it's something that we're going to be watching for the future. We'll probably be back in touch with both of you. Thank you again very much, A, for joining us, and B, for staying on for the extended time to begin to explore this fascinating topic of robotics. Thank you both.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yep.
Thank you, Professor Whitaker. Well, as you heard there, and we've only touched on the tip of it, I wish we had gotten further, and I wish that we had had more time to get further, because there's much more happening than we really got into, and I think we kept a relatively safe and a positive spin on the situation. I'm not sure that spin is justified. Even with Hanson Robotics, they've created one robot named Joey Chaos, a real nice-looking robot. He's got his ears and his lips pierced and looks just like any other young man with ears and lips pierced. And Joey Chaos is a robot that's got a personality of an edgy, hyper-sexualized punk rocker. The robot isn't, as quote David Hanson, the creator of this robot, the robot isn't afraid to be a jerk. So there is obviously a lot that can be put into the personality and the character of the robot. And how far this is going to go is, well, let me just read you my commentary because it addresses the issues, and these are the things I really want you to think about, and I wish we'd gotten into a little bit more with our guest, but you take it, you think about it, you let me know what you think. Now, as you know, the future is very, very exciting these days, and more than a bit frightening. And frankly, that's the way it should be. A future that is exciting and maybe a bit frightening is a future that requires us to think, develop, and adapt. As our guest, and we didn't get time to talk about it, Dr. William Red Whitaker, robot designer and Carnegie Mellon professor, said in one of his articles regarding addressing the future and the possibility of robot domination of us, he said, quote, "Well, it's not like there's a plot afoot. It just happens quietly over time. Things get added on to existing technologies," unquote. But that implies, obviously, that more things get added, more capabilities, better functions, better, deeper understanding to the robot, better and deeper than any of us. As we've pointed out already in the show, there are many robots that can do so many more things that we already can't do. Technology necessary grows. To a large degree, this path is now inevitable that we keep on adding things, qualities, abilities to the existing robots. Once again, we are left with, so what are we going to do about this brave robot world? Well, now, if Moore's law does apply to robots as it does to computers, if robots' power, ability, and memory double every 2 years, and so far they do, in the last 26 years, the robot's capabilities, memories, ability, and power has doubled 13 times every 2 years, then just how long will it be before robots actually surpass humans in most arenas? And what is to stop this cumulative growth? as robots are programmed and achieve autonomy, and yes, autonomy is required despite sort of Dr. Whitaker's shying away from it, and so is distinction, their choice, then they are likely, in fact, to decide their future, and possibly ours. In any case, they will grow in service and in independence. Complexity requires that. If this prediction that I'm making is valid, and from what I've read, there's nothing that refutes it, and if it is irrefutable, then we as a species must decide how exactly, and we must decide now, how we are going to use robots, how we are going to relate to them, how are we going to limit them, how are we going to enforce any limitation, and where do we apply the limitation? To the creator of the robot? Or do we have to actually catch the already created robot and apply the limitation to him? If in the creation of robots, being created in our likeness requires us to truly understand our processes and to understand our characteristics, to thereby perfect some self-preserving characteristics and remove some self-destructing characteristics from the robot, which is the goal of Hanson Robotics, how can we therefore not create a more perfect being? A being that is actually more perfect than us, or a machine, if you want, that is more perfect than us. And this is what robotics is really doing. They are studying us to create the artificial intelligence that, in fact, has fewer of our flaws and more of our best attributes. If we succeed, will not this autonomous, discriminating robot not notice, as does Mr. Smith in Matrix 1, that we, the human species, tend to be a cancer on this planet? Is this science fiction or is this our inevitable future? If the latter, and if we truly do or can learn to value ourselves and our neighbors when we had best pay attention and demand of our governments action and restraint and universal codes of conduct and development, the creators of robots are already here now. The robots are here now. And the future is already here now. And that is what's at stake. The robots, like it or not, are a big part already of your future. I'm Terry D. Kester. I thank you very much for joining me on What's at Stake. I hope you'll give this topic some thought. It bears investigation. I'll be with you again next week. Join us in Raucous Caucus Tuesday nights. Thank you, Perry, for doing great engineering as always. Thank all of you for listening. Thank all of WPFW staff for supporting us. We'll be with you soon. Africa Now is next. Stay tuned.